You're listening to the Forest School Podcast, delicious waffle chat about education, nature connection, child development, community building, and lots more. Hosted by Lewis Ames and Wem Sutherland. Rock and roll. Hi, listeners. We are here today. We are here with Peter Kinefield.
Kinefield.
Always, I suddenly get very hesitant whenever I go for someone's last name. Just slightly makes me go, second guess myself. Peter and I have been exchanging messages for a while. We've been looking at Peter's blog and different things like that. And we wanted to come on the podcast and have a chat, like free flow, you know, as we do, back and forwards. But Peter, for people that haven't heard about you and your blog and things like that before, would you be able to give us a bit of background about who you are, what you do, and you know, what you're up to at the moment?
Sure. So I am trained as a science educator, and I've done a lot of stuff in schools. I've always been focused on ecology and learning, you know, about ecosystems. And surprisingly, I was slow to come to realize that being outside all the time while I'm teaching that kind of content is important. And then all of the other kinds of content that I think are important to not just sort of knowing, you know, Western ecology, but really feeling like a participant in ecosystems. My sort of tagline these days is nurturing educational environments and communities that feel more like playing in the forest and less like working in a factory. And I've always been very critical of factory schools. And as I said, it was sort of late in the game that I realized, oh, forest school is kind of the opposite of a factory school, and is what I'm really into. So, you know, after a long career as professor and science coordinator and all of that kind of stuff, I have now I teach deep nature connection and nature-based science out in the forest with kids, and it fills my heart with joy.
Amazing. And we wanted to get on today because we wanted to chat about, I mean, looking through your work, there were loads of different places we were kind of like, oh, we could link up on that, we could link up on this. We've got all these kind of crossover things, but the one we settled on that I think is really interesting, we haven't really touched on it too much before, is this idea of how in our programs we're merging or balancing, I'm going to put different verbs in there to give myself some backpedal room, the indigenous and ancient knowledge that comes quite often is sort of wrapped up in being outdoors and being with nature. And then there's like the modern, and like you were saying with your background of the scientific and the kind of predominantly westernized views, and how we hold both of those things in kind while we're out in the woods and we're in different places. So our historical stuff is very, well, the UK has got an interesting history. Let's sum it up that way. But I do think we're in an interesting, because so you're based in the States, aren't you?
Yes.
Where specifically? I'm not sure I know specifically where.
I'm up in the San Jacinto Mountains in Southern California, which is, you know, mostly a desert, but we're 6,000 feet up. And so like right now we're in the middle of a snowstorm.
Well, if you disappear, we'll know what's happened.
That's right.
So we've got these kind of different things, because I think, Wem, I was talking to you about this the other day, that the UK is in this really interesting position where I think there is a resurgence in the awareness, popularity of kind of Celtic traditions and these things. But we are, you know, if you want to take the Roman invasion of as part of when the big sweep of Celtic people were moved across, we're several thousand years away from that indigenous move. And obviously in the States, you guys are in a very different position. So it'd be interesting to compare and contrast how we navigate these different things from different places. When would you say that's fair to say there's like a Celtic resurgence going on?
I mean, it's hard to know, isn't it, whether there is a resurgence or whether it's just the pool that we move in. And so more and more people are maybe marking what we call the wheel of the year and seasonal festivals and things like that. And obviously, like, knowledge of those kind of things, I think, spreads quite easily through social media, through things like Instagram, because it's very image friendly in terms of, you know, I've made this thing for Imolc on the 1st of February, or I've created this ritual or this tradition, and it's quite a nice, attractive thing to kind of share. And so I think people are becoming more aware of it, for sure. But yeah, with the UK, we've got so many different periods and different peoples to choose from, almost, and then maybe a lack of actual evidence about what they might have known, what they might have done, how they may have lived. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I wonder, one of the things I made a note about was that these different ways that we access that knowledge, because we were talking about, you know, how do we, not just how do we hold the knowledge, but how do we access it? And Peter, you know, it sounds like from your background, you've got this, the westernized education science bit. That bit, I think, for most of us comes from state education. That's kind of where we're exposed to it, would you say? But, well, yes, and Peter's sticking his tongue out there, but that is our, that's our kind of foremost way in, at least here. Would you say that's true for you guys?
Yeah. Definitely, I think that most people gain their nature knowledge in formal schooling, and it's somewhat of a disaster. I had a student who had actually been with me for a while, and also spent a lot of time in public school, and we were talking about plants, and he said, well, you know, plants all grow far apart from each other because they're all super competitive. And I thought that that was super funny, particularly since where we live is sort of, there's a lot of chaparral, which is really characterized by big clumps of plants that all support each other. And that students, you know, formal knowledge sort of overpowered his own observations. And we, you know, immediately went out into the forest to take a look around and see how wrong he was.
What was their reaction to that, though, when they went out and you went, hey, you know that thing you've said? Here it is. How did that play out?
I think he had a bit of an aha moment. I mean, that's a huge emphasis of what I work on from the, you know, Western end, is that the story of, you know, that everything is competitive in nature, as you both know well, is just silly. And so we spend a lot of time talking about mutualism and cooperation and apparently, you know, getting some visceral confirmation that, hey, plants like each other, you know, led to a little bit of an aha moment.
That really reminds me of Suzanne Simard's Finding the Mother Tree. Have you read that?
I have not.
Oh, okay. She's like, that whole idea of the wood wide web and how trees communicate and cooperate with each other using fungi. So she found this had to spend such a long time trying to convince people, including scientists that she knew, that this was the case, because this idea of trees being in competition with one another and trying to outcompete for light and nutrients was so strong and really rooted in the forestry industry. And that's where she was working. And so they were kind of doing all these things about, like, get rid of all of these other species of tree because they're competing for the same resources and they're not valuable. So kill all those trees and nurture these other ones. And it took ages to literally prove these birch trees, for example, are actually supporting the pine or whatever it was they were growing, or the fir. And it is, I guess, it's going back to that kind of, like, we view, if we've got into this kind of industrialized, you use the word, the term factory schools, we've got into this kind of way of being in the Western world that we kind of maybe project that as well onto nature and go, well, of course, everyone's just fighting for survival, aren't they? Everyone's trying to get the best bit of pie. Is that true?
It's a whole other tack that we could take, but I find it fascinating, is that a lot of the scientists who have made the most profound discoveries about interdependence are women. Another one of my, female heroes is Lynn Margulis, who was very involved in the Gaia hypothesis and in demonstrating that the way that eukaryotic cells came about was through cooperation among bacteria.
What were those cells you just mentioned?
Eukaryotic, just the cells.
Can you explain what that is? I don't know what that is.
All the cells in the human body have organelles, and Lynn Margulis's serial endosymbiotic hypothesis was that those cells all came around from bacteria interacting and cooperating, not necessarily in a friendly way. I mean, she points out that the first organelle was probably a product of a bigger bacteria eating a smaller bacteria, and the smaller bacteria ending up making it, and being able to integrate. And yeah, I love that piece, and we talk a lot in our classes about fungi. One of my pet peeves is people call, at least in the States, talk about nitrogen fixing plants, and there are no plants that can fix nitrogen. Nitrogen fixation is done by bacteria the fundamental story is that plants that are called nitrogen fixing plants actually call in, using chemical signaling, nitrogen fixing bacteria. Even provide homes for them. So you can pull the roots of nitrogen fixing plants and see these little nodules that are where the nitrogen fixers hang out.
And is that the same as mycelium? Like, is that, are the fungi involved in that process?
Hi, listeners. Before we continue with the rest of today's episode, I wanted to take a moment to give a big shout out to our sponsor, Skillshare. Skillshare is the ultimate platform for learning new skills and honing your craft, with thousands of online classes taught by experts in their various fields. Guess what? As a token of appreciation to our amazing listeners, Skillshare is offering an exclusive deal. Simply click on the link in the podcast show notes and you'll get a fantastic 30% discount on your Skillshare membership. That's right, 30%. So whether you're interested in photography, creative writing, or mastering new software, Skillshare has got you covered. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity to enhance your skills and unleash your creativity. Thank you, Skillshare, for supporting our show and helping us provide valuable waffle chats to our listeners. Now let's get back to the rest of today's episode.
Well, so, I have a write-up in one of my blogs. Those are separate events, but they're very closely related. And a lot of times there are triple collaborations. So in a lot of plants, in all plants, nitrogen-fixing bacteria play a super important role. And in, it seems like the vast majority of plants, fungi also play a role. A little bit different, but similar.
That's really interesting. That kind of leads in. One of the things I was trying to pick out when I was thinking about so we're talking about this kind of observable knowledge versus the knowledge that might be in textbooks or the stuff that gets like handed down to us. When they ask me for, you talk about something that, how it works or why we do a certain thing in the woods. And I've started going, well, would you like the science answer or the woo-woo answer? Because they're both the same thing, but I can give you whichever one you'd like. And so one of the examples I always think about is in the UK, we have stories about the elder tree, and that there's a witch that lives in the elder tree. And before you take any elder, you have to put your hand on. And what's the poem?
Oh, you can say, you have to ask permission before you take any of the elder wood, and you can say something like, old woman, may I have some of your wood? I promise that I will give you some of mine when I am a tree, and listen for the answer before you take the wood.
And it has all this thing of, we're very reverential about it, and it must never be burnt. And that's the kind of like spiritual bit, and also the kind of, I'm not sure indigenous is the right word.
Well, cultural, you could
cultural
say.
Cultural thing that comes with it from the UK. But then there's the sort of clinical element of it, which is burning elder releases, I think, cyanide into the air, which is a clinical reason not to burn it. And also that apparently there are some stories in the UK of there being a very harsh winter people cutting down the elder trees to burn for firewood, and then there not being elderberries. So in the spring, when people had colds and stuff, there were no elderberries for the medicinal things like that. So I find it really interesting when you go, well, here's the cultural story that gives us advice. Now, they didn't necessarily have this clinical scientific understanding of why it worked, but they knew it worked. They knew it was important to hand that stuff down. Do you have similar stuff in the States with the sort of knowledge that's passed over there?
Well, so one of the things that fascinates me, Lewis, is that, you know, in this distinction, which I really never thought of until we first spoke, is the difference between being in a, you know, former colony and versus being in a place where there's a little bit more integration between ancestral knowledge and modern folk, right? So my ancestral knowledge is, you know, Russian and Mediterranean. And here I am, like pretty much, everyone other than the people who survived the genocide are people whose ancestral knowledge and the land-based knowledge are very, very distinct. And so, you know, to me, like, I've been thinking a lot about how to talk about land-based skills, or sometimes I like to, because I'm a former educator and in the States, everyone calls, you know, math and writing basic skills. Sometimes I like to talk about survival skills or ancestral skills as just being basic skills. But anyway, that distinction between, you know, the land that folks are on here, the majority of the people who live in this country aren't from here for a very, very long time. And so, but I do personally super value that, you know, what I call an attitude of gratitude, that we do get from the folk who have lived on this land for thousands and thousands of years. And so I definitely teach gratitude practice with plants. And for me, you know, there definitely is a difference between sort of Western knowledge, whatever, you know, Northern, the dominant culture, scientific knowledge, and ancestral knowledge. But there's also a lot of, for me, I wrote a poem once called A Scientist's View of the Sacred. And I was, I'll give you an example of an exercise I do with kids. I have kids just stick their face into greenery and I say, breathe. Wow. And I let them breathe for a little while. And then I go, that tree is now building itself from your out-breath. You got the oxygen that you can't live without from a byproduct of a chemical reaction in that plant. You can eat the, you know, manzanita berry and get sugar that that plant produced from energy from the sun. What is more sacred or amazing or spiritual or mystical than that? Even though we can, you know, go through the scientific explanation, that's amazing. And so, you know, one of the things I talk about sometimes is like why I teach organic chemistry as part of forest school. And I do because I think it's interesting to kind of see the, you know, symbolic sort of hardcore stuff behind that incredibly intimate connection that all animals have with all plants.
I love that. And I love especially what you said there about saying that the plant has benefited from the human breathing with it, because I think with a lot of sort of eco-awareness and climate crisis awareness, there's a lot of anxiety and there's a lot of kind of shame about being human and what we're doing to the planet. And we have this discussion quite often with our grown-up trainees who kind of come to us to learn to be forest school leaders. And I remember having a discussion with one of our students who was saying, I'm really finding it hard to kind of describe the rationale for my forest school practice and about how we're going to benefit the environment that we're using, because we've got this kind of small amount of ground with some trees and some shrubs and some grass and a pond, and I'm having to write this kind of management plan for the land, and I'm looking at it and I'm going, how are we going to, like, we're trashing it. Like, there's no, I'm beginning to think I just shouldn't even do this, because in the management plan, I'm trying to look at how I can benefit wildlife and increase biodiversity. And I'm just thinking humans can't do that. The fact that we're here is always going to be negative. And he came from a gardening background. And I was really interested to engage with him in that conversation, because I could completely see where he was coming from. And at the same time, I was a complete advocate for, no, you need to get these kids outside and they need to be on the land. So having a little example like that, where you can literally say your existence is beneficial to that plant in that moment is quite a rare moment, I think.
Yes. And I think, you know, like you, I think it's super, super important that, you know, one of the big things that happens in the States around that is that we have this idea that, you know, there's all of these reserved lands that are, you know, basically reserved for, you know, white people with money. And we practice conservation, which means leaving them alone. And I'm in the midst of reading this great monster book called Tending the Wild that basically points out that, you know, what Columbus, you know, discovered when he showed up here was managed ecosystems coast to coast, and that there's this mythology, you know, among people from the dominant culture that, you know, it was all of this, you know, land that humans had no impact on. And then, you know, as you're saying, when the folks who, you know, ecologically oriented people going, oh, you know, well, we need to leave the land alone. We need to leave some land alone so that it's okay. And of course, what's happened is we've created, you know, vast amounts of acreage that are prone to wildfire, because we haven't been managing the land in any way. And so, you know, human beings' involvement in mutualistic relationships in nature, I think, is a very, very big deal that people have to get. You know,
I think also it kind of comes, that kind of mindset, I feel like also comes the other side of that coin, is quite often the idea that, well, we've left this bit, which means we can do whatever we want with this bit. Because we're leaving this bit alone, that gives us free rein to, and that's where the, you know, a lot of damage, leaving woods and stuff alone, you know, even in our climate, would be ecologically not great. There would be trees that would fall and take healthy trees with them, and there would be, you know, invasive stuff would start to creep in and all these things. But sometimes I think people, have that view of like, well, we've left that, that's a wildlife conservation, so we don't touch that. But that we've done that so that we can concrete these 200 acres over here. And somehow that's like a, rather than finding a balance all over and going, okay, this has to be balance in all of these places, it's like that completely compartmentalized, that's for nature and that's for us.
Yes.
And rather than, you know.
Yeah. I think that's so central. In a lot of different domains, one of the things I like to talk about is, you know, synthesis. And for me, you know, it shows up a lot in how people think about how we take care of learning environments. It is the same, you know, we can get into the same thing. So, you know, now we're doing academic versus now we're doing free play, or I even, you know, some of my friends, and I understand why they ask, but posed a question recently, which was kind of like, how much of your forest school is student directed and how much of it is teacher directed? And my commentary was, God, none of my time is either of those things. I'm hanging out with kids who I have, established a mutualistic relationship with, and we go out in the woods together and we talk about what we're doing. And yeah, there are times where, you know, we're all carving and I'm not really, you know, and so you might say, well, that's free time. And there's other time where we're all talking. But when we're talking, it's like I invite them to come talk with me. And if they don't feel like it, they don't have to. You know, so it really is this integration rather than, you know, some of this and some of that. Just like, you know, with how human beings can be in nature and it being ridiculous if it's some of, you know, destruction and some of leaving alone instead of all of working together.
Yeah, it's that holistic view, isn't it? I was literally having that conversation with somebody today where another adult was asking me if I'd ever worked with teenagers. And I said, I explained that I'd worked in a secondary state school for 9 years and and I really loved working with teenagers, and I was kind of trying to reflect on why that was and thinking about being in the classroom and going, oh, if I'm in the classroom, these are the things I prefer about being in the classroom with teenagers. And then I realized what, and I was sort of explaining why and talking about the conversations we had and the depth and the interest of what their ideas were, and as I was speaking I was like, hang on a minute, I get all of that here in the woods, in this environment, with a group of young people aged from, at the moment, 5 to 10, you know, who would be primary age children here in the UK. And I suddenly realised, oh my gosh, it's not actually the age of the children, it's the environment and the attitude and the community structure. So if I had to be in charge of a classroom, I'm going to choose the teenagers. But actually what I'm striving for, what I enjoy is the fact, is an environment where we can have the time and the space and the freedom to have any kind of conversation that might come up. And I would have just as in-depth and thought-provoking discussions with a 6 or 7 year old in the woods now than I would with a teenager in a classroom, because we've got the space and the time to do it. And because our hierarchy is so much more different, there is so much less hierarchy there, that they, you know, weight can be given to their ideas, and because we have time to do that, you know.
I think there's also something there. I wonder if you think this is true of your experience, Wendo, that there's like a, Peter, like you were saying about, there's like this shared focus of like, sometimes we're all carving or sometimes we're all doing this. And so I think when you're, my experience of state education teaching primary age children is that very much it's like, your attention should be on the activity. My attention is on making sure you do the activity. That's the disconnect here, which is why that feels different. Whereas I can remember the experience of being a teenager and having those moments like you're describing, Wen, where you're like, I think because you're becoming a young adult, there are some topics or some conversations where you and your teacher are more on a part, you know, you suddenly get to that point where you talk about a TV show that you like, or a certain band that's coming to, you know, tour nearby, and you and the teacher, your interests zone in that like co-regulation kind of way.
Yeah.
And
or even you're just both genuinely interested in the book that you're reading as part of the lesson, you know, but you're interested in the same.
But doing that with any age children in the, like you're saying, when the community setup that we have, when we go and look at, so Peter, at the moment, we've got a dead deer in our woods that I found on the road. And we pulled it in to see who comes to eat the dead deer. I'm really interested in it. But so are the kids. Yeah. And they're interested in going to see it and going to look at it. And has it been opened up a bit more and look at that? And like, I'm not doing it as a, okay, I've set this up, let me show you this, I'm going to teach this, my goal is that you come away with these objectives. It is just a shared focus on, let's go look at it, let's go explore this place together, and I'm open to all the ideas and things you might throw out. Yeah. You know, that's kind of what I think separates this from that, this kind of experiential, you know, cultural learning from the potentially a lot more top-down science exposure. Okay, I have these equations, you need to learn these reactions. If you do or don't, that's how I assess your value, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting how much information sharing one can do while maintaining the spirit that you guys are talking, you know, that I do have like a lot of conversations about, you know, what's happening behind why, you know, we're seeing what looks like smoke coming out of our mouth when we're breathing while it's snowing and that kind of stuff. But again, only in the spirit of, you know, co-interest. And I love it when there are times where I'll like preemptively, I feel like I've been talking too much and I'll say, okay, well, we could just get up and go sledding. And the kids are like, no, we want to talk about this more.
It's kind of modeling what's okay as well, isn't it? That, you know, we as adults with maybe a bit more life experience and knowledge about a particular field will take those moments, as you describe. But then it shows the kids, because of the structure we're working in, that it's okay for them to do that too. So the amount of times that kids come up to me and go, Wem, do you know about this Pokemon that actually it's got this power? Oh, no, you don't get it. It's the, you know, and they are the expert of their subject and yeah. they feel confident and okay to yeah. teach me about it. And yeah. it's yeah. yeah, it's mutual.
And there's one student that I've had, I mean, I'm sure it's happened with others, but like twice, he's probably about, I guess, 14 now. We had disagreements where I came to his point of view, where I really was trying to deliver a message. One of them, you guys will get a kick out of, I think I have this thing where I talk about, like, what's the difference between being on a computer, in a house, and out in nature, and looking at those things in detail. And of course, you know, my point of view is sort of basically how everything's better, gets better and better the closer to the trees you are. And the student raised a really wonderful point, which he said, we were sitting on a boulder and he goes, yeah, it's often more comfortable inside.
Yeah.
And so I was much. Like, you know, and I really didn't want to hear it at first. And yet, you know, here I am, like I don't love the cold, and I don't even know if I'm going to go out in this beautiful snowstorm that we're having. I really like being comfortable. So anyway, that giving them, just respecting their knowledge, creates an environment where, you know, I used to get thrown out of classrooms for disagreeing with my teachers when I was a kid. Mm-hmm.
Hey, outdoor leaders, are you familiar with that feeling of spending the whole day holding other people's needs, trying to keep spirits up by cooking treats over the fire, only to get home and be faced with yet more mental load and cooking chores? We get it, it's exhausting. But what if we told you there's a game changer that could make your evenings a whole lot easier? Enter HelloFresh, the household name in meal kit delivery. You've probably heard of them, but have you given them a try? If not, now's the perfect time to experience the convenience and deliciousness that they bring to the table. And guess what? As a thank you for supporting our show, HelloFresh is offering our listeners an incredible deal. Just follow the link in our podcast show notes to enjoy a fantastic 60% off your first box, plus 25% off for the next 2 months, along with some free gifts. Imagine coming home to a box full of fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and easy-to-follow recipes, ready to help you whip up tasty meals without the stress. It's like having a personal sous chef right in your kitchen. So why not give yourself a break and let HelloFresh do the heavy listening? Click on that link in the show notes and treat yourself to some well-deserved relaxation. Thank you again to HelloFresh for supporting outdoor leaders like us. Well, just on that point, that's super interesting, because I think there is also something here which I didn't make a note about, but it's just occurred to me as you're describing that, which is that quite often cultural knowledge or like land-based knowledge comes with an assumption that, or comes maybe with a, maybe assumption's not the right word, almost like a prerequisite that like that's where you're supposed to be the most comfortable. Like that's where, you know, like outdoors is, I'm going to put on a voice because I'm playing a character now. That's where we've been for the longest time. That's where we evolved. That's where we did all the things. And so I think for a lot of people, they can be put off of that cultural knowledge or land-based knowledge if that doesn't resonate with them immediately. If they come into a space where someone's going, oh, isn't it free? Isn't it great? And I'm not saying that that's what the thing you set up, but those spheres, lots of those spheres are equally as dogmatic about how you should feel about an experience. Yes. And that can be an interesting balance to hold that kind of cultural thing, which is really valuing and showing gratitude for the outdoors, but also respecting the individual's right to go, yeah, but not for me. And yeah, that sounds like, you know, that's the kind of experience you're describing in there, is like, you know, living in a bubble. I think sometimes there's a drive to embed past beliefs or past cultural knowledge that can only really work in a vacuum. You know, if it's like, well, it'll work as long as the kids never see a screen, and it works as long as they don't ever read books about different cultures, or it works as long as they only ever come to this space. But we have to, I think, I would say in our practice at least, we have to be ready to go, this is what you're bringing, this is where you are on your journey. We're just going to have these cultural chats and conversations rather than being cultural downloads. Do you know what I mean? They're not just like, here it is, learn it. Which is, you know, very interesting. I wonder if all three of us have been working in the outdoors for a long time now. And one of the questions that I wrote down for us was like, how long, or if we have any experiences where we can tell quite quickly, like a participant's experiences, and whether you go, you come from a super sciencey background, or you go, your stuff is all, based in folk traditions, of whether you've had that experience, Peter. I don't know if that's come up with you.
In terms of responding to the, in terms of what the kids bring to.
Yeah. So like sometimes, for example, like for us, because we have children join our group at all different times. And sometimes we would have someone come in, and within, this would be an extreme example, some kids would come in and immediately with the parent that they're with go, well, let's go say hello to the trees, let's go hug them and do the thing. And you go, okay, I know the background you're coming to this space, yes, to. And sure. Then I've had other parents where I would have said on the face of it, not super nature connected. And then I think I once mentioned, what's the word? Dicots, you know, the first two leaf things that come out. And this parent went off for 20 minutes. She went, oh yeah, that's what I did my PhD in, and I know all about these things, and I did that. But had shown no spiritual, cultural nature connection up to that point. It really threw me that she had that much like knowledge in the log, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I do see some of that. I don't work with adults that much anymore. I do a sort of toddler and parent class, and I do see vast differences in in how the parents respond with their kids. Yeah. And it's, it's super sad to me. Like I very often, Webb, you were talking about following the kids and how important that is in places. And I do that with my toddlers. Like, I just think they're so fucking brilliant about being out in nature. And so, I've had these experiences where like the kids are the first to take off their shoes and jump in the mud. And I can see the parents are about to go, don't do that. And then they look over and I'm quickly taking off my shoes going, what a great idea. where the kids are, little ones are just walking along, and all of a sudden they throw themselves on the ground and look up at the sky. And I go, what a brilliant move. And I throw myself on the ground and look up at the sky, and all the parents are kind of standing around going, and it's sort of funny for me now, because I'm in my 60s and they're in their 20s or 30s, and they just seem so uptight.
Yeah, you got to give them time. Just,
Time is the answer.
more sessions, more visits, yes, more invitations, yes, for them.
Yes.
I was reading your blog, Peter, your Substack, and there's loads of great stuff on there. I really recommend any listeners to go there, and we'll make sure we put the link in the show notes. But I noticed we really align in our practice and our belief in play and the importance of play. And since we're kind of talking a little bit about like land knowledge and skills and that kind of stuff, I wondered if one of the things I find really fascinating about play is that when you observe children playing for a certain amount of time, a lot of them will often get into these stages of kind of recapitulative play, where they are acting out stuff that is from our evolutionary past. So rather than us telling them, oh, we could mix this mud with this, or this clay with this stuff, and we could make cob, or we could make bricks, you know, they are discovering that for themselves through play, through experimentation, and then that leads them off into an imaginary game where they're now making clay bricks in a way that their ancestors might have been doing, even maybe on that exact spot thousands of years ago. You know, there is naturally clay in the ground in that place, and like, let's mix it together and make building materials of some kind. And the kids are discovering that, rather than us going, now, children, you may notice that this soil is a different color, and actually, historically, it was used for this. You know, they're discovering. And I wondered if you had similar experiences where you're observing children kind of, yeah, visiting their evolutionary pasts in any way, and whether, and also what that might look like in the landscape where you are. What kind of things might, do they kind of start doing when they're learning through play and interacting with natural materials and resources, because you've written quite a lot about that.
It's interesting. I guess, you know, while I do put a huge value on play, and I absolutely agree with everything that you said, I also, with everybody but my toddlers, I do come from a place, and maybe too much, where I have an agenda that I am kind of watching to see emerge from their play. So, you know, while I do see a lot of kids getting, like I had this interesting experience relatively recently where an older kid was telling me about how younger kids have really short attention spans. And I was thinking about watching these younger kids, you know, this was like a 12-year-old talking about, I guess, 7-year-olds. And, you know, what I definitely see is kids who are, you know, maybe arrive kind of a little bit jittery and, you know, spend an hour and a half without moving off a log, carving, or, you know, doing a reverse twist cordage. Yeah. And just getting into that experience and it being like, you know, no, I don't want to go any place or do, I don't want to go back to my parents now. I'm making corn. So I guess I see less discovery. Again, I think mostly because I have relatively limited time with the kids, and I do come with, you know, recommend a lot of activities and that kind of stuff. So I don't see maybe as much discovery as you do, but I do see a lot of getting into that rhythm. I wonder if I could hop back a step, because there's something that I wanted to mention at the beginning that I kind of,
cool.
You know, for me, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, sort of looking back at my time and going, you know, I taught 40 years ago in a classroom where what we were doing was designing a biosphere. And the concept I wanted them to get was interdependence. And it took me so long to recognize what you guys, you know in your bones and seem to have known for quite a while, which is the importance of land-based skills to really getting ecosystems. And I think in a way this ties together a couple of threads, you know, we've been chatting about. I came up with this metaphor because I've been trying to think about like what it must feel like to be on planet Earth and have no idea how to survive here. And so, you know, my latest metaphor is if you spend your whole life in an ocean, you have to have like a certain amount of insecurity. Because you don't, if, sorry, I didn't set that up right. If you don't know how to swim and you spend your life on an ocean liner, you got to have some insecurity about the fact that you don't know how to make it where you are without being enclosed in all of this technology. And, you know, what I started to realize is, yeah, you can, and, you know, again, these are themes that both of you have brought up throughout this conversation. You can be told everything is interdependent, but if you don't feel interdependent, then you don't get interdependence. And so, you know, when I watch these kids sort of come alive because they're eating berries off of trees and, you know, picking things out of the ground and eating it and working in our garden and playing around in the compost pile, and they're really getting these, you know, what I consider like basic survival skills that, you know, frankly, I didn't have for most of my life. I mean, I don't know how I made it all that time living in a world where, you know, if I was outside and I got cold, I, you know, beyond pulling my jacket tighter, wouldn't have known how to start a fire so I could get warm. Or, so yeah, I mean, I have come to see the learning of these, you know, land-based skills as so, so central to just being able to be happy on Earth and to gaining some understanding of mutualistic relationships and cooperation and, you know, how ecosystems work.
Yeah, yeah, I've never thought of it in that way, of the importance for feeling at home in the world. I think that's a really good point to make, and kind of, yeah, links back to what we were saying about feeling that, being ashamed for being human and feeling that all we do is yeah, damage things, that to understand how our creativity is, yeah, part of the ecosystem and necessary, helpful. That's yeah, that's a really interesting way of looking at it.
But you know, Lewis, your point I think is just so well taken, that even, you know, so given that, I do have a little bit of a tendency, I think, and I'm learning something from talking with you, to kind of want to just, you know, go, hey, swimming's fun, you know, and grab the kids and throw them overboard. And that sort of works some, you know, for me in my current environment, because I am in this almost sad situation where all of the kids I get are, their parents chose to send them to my classes, right? And the kids chose to go. And that's a totally different situation than, I don't really get what you were talking about, Lewis. I don't get people coming who are like, I don't really want to be outside. Or I'm not comfortable in the natural world. Don't tell me, you know, I should be. They're all like, I am. You know, the kids that I get, I describe as being profoundly different than adults. You know, adults sort of, I say, walk through the forest like they're walking through the hole in a donut. They're not really in the forest. They're kind of on the path, kind of, you know, almost like, I don't know if you all have these aquarium, you know, exhibit hall aquariums where you walk through a hallway and you're under the fish and they're all around you, but you're there in their ecosystem and you're in yours. Well, that's how adults strike me in woods. And the kids I get, and I know there are kids like that, but the kids that I get, they're just, you know, into the woods, like that they disappear behind into the trees and under the, you know, under the leaf litter.
I'll tell you what, I've got a metaphor for you then, going on those aquarium things, because I saw a video yesterday of an aquarium, yeah, one of those tunnel things, and there's sharks going through. I don't know if you saw this web. I think it was in the UK, and the tank had cracked. The roof was leaking, and there, and it's people, and someone's filming it on their phone, and there's two divers on in the water, and there's someone there inside. It was amazing. So there's like sharks floating around over there, and the person inside the tunnel's got a mop, and they're just pushing the mop against the roof to try and help. But so there's a metaphor. I feel like if you're saying that, you know, sometimes adults walk through the woods, and predominantly it's adults, some kids also walk through in that kind of way, but that trickle of water getting in, sometimes I feel quite mischievously is my role, like that's the bubble. And then there's me, I've found a crack. You've come to this group, and I am going to just go, I'm going to be so chaotically compassionate and happy that you will have no choice but to sort of accept what I'm doing and go with it. And that's the little crack in the aquarium tank. That's me getting in and just going, you know, here we are. Let's do this thing. Yeah, it's going to be a bit You know, I think there's something. I could probably draw it as a graph, in the way we're talking about that kind of interdependence thing and feeling safe and secure. And I think there's that thing. I don't know if you would agree this with Wen, but some people come to the woods because our programs are really long term. We've had some kids with us for 7-8 years. You know, every yeah. you know we get to them over a long time, and. Yes. I think there might be something where people come into the woods and some people mask how they're feeling by going whole hog the other way, by going, I'm in this place and I guess what's expected of me is that I love nature. And so they jump in, they go, oh, I'm going to run, I'm going to play, I'm going to do this thing. And then sometimes it's a couple of sessions, sometimes it's a couple of months. You see the interdependence come up and the feeling of safety come up. And you see potentially their comfort level in nature go down because they're not masking it anymore to pretend right. that thing is still there. And then it's our job and all our journey to safely bring it back up, like you're saying, with those skills, with those land-based skills, with those like, how can we accommodate this, with those like, let's mediate some social interactions if that's what's going on. You know, there is definitely, I think, that hump for a lot of people where they might run in and be like super okay, like stick fighting or bows and arrows is a big one. People are like, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, 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 go, 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 go. And then you see in a couple of weeks or a couple of sessions, them not really knowing what to do, not feeling super comfortable. Sure. And then you can just come back in and go, okay, so now I'm seeing where you really are and I'm going to come up with you. And a lot of the time, that can come from, and this was one of the notes I made, is I feel like that for a lot of people comes through, we call them, we have social stories in the UK. Is that a term that's across the pond? This idea of like, almost like metaphor stories, you know, like you're telling a story and then at the end of it, you don't make a big deal of hamming on like, and that little boy is actually going through something very similar to you, isn't he? But you just tell the story so they can have an experience of like, you know, this thing. And there's definitely something, Wem and I do lots of cultural stories, lots of old, very old. I particularly really love an old story in terms of bringing connecting people to land and connecting people to culture. Partly because I think they're really good and really, you know, if they've survived this long, they must have something, you know. Sure. But also there's quite often something that is just batshit insane in old stories. You know, they'll just go like, of course he was carrying a fork in his top left pocket, as everyone did, and then they just move on in the story. What the fuck was that? I don't know what's going on in this thing. Do you do much storytelling as part of your practice?
Well, what's funny is I've been doing more and more, but I tend to do it. I mean, the only, you know, the sort of fables like from my childhood pretty much are all horrifying.
Good. That's the way it should be.
You know, Rockabye Baby and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I do a lot of my science teaching from the point of view of story. And it drives my wife crazy because she says that I'm anthropomorphizing, and I'm kind of all about anthropomorphizing.
I think that's a good thing.
And, you know, so like I'll talk about, you know, like when I talk about nitrogen fixing, you know, plants, I'll start out with, you know, nitrogen is this weird stuff. Our atmosphere is mostly nitrogen. And nitrogen is this funny kind of atoms because they love to cling to each other. And so you typically find nitrogen in pairs holding on to each other with each holding on to the other with three arms. And they're so tightly coupled. The only beings who can break them apart are these bacteria that can actually separate out those nitrogens, and then they can share it with their, put it in a form that they can share with their friends, the plants.
Mate, if you'd said that when I was 14, I wouldn't have been skipping chemistry classes. I used to go off into the woods because I didn't like, but you could tell stories like that all the time. I'm here for it, man. That's
it's memorable, and isn't it?
Yeah. And it's the same with me. I mean, I hated that stuff when I chemistry just seemed like, because it was just taught as if it had, you know, anyway. So yeah.
Peter, I'm conscious that it's a different time zone for you. Thank you so much for chatting with us. This has been enlightening and joyful. If people have listened to this and when mentioned, we'll put your blog and your Substack in the show notes. But if people are listening and they want to find out more about what you're up to, where can they go to?
The best place is my Substack. Okay. And also I have a I post a lot in the forest, in the forest groups. And when I'm when my sessions start up again, I'll be posting a lot in there's a Facebook group called Ecological Education. I'll be posting there. I just have to say, I'm going to be I've listened to some. I'm going to be listening to more of your work. I always really enjoy and sort of feel like I'm in conversation. When there was a time where you brought up, you started talking about assessment in public schools.
Oh, right.
And I yes, exactly. I was like, oh man, I got to get in this conversation with you. Okay, we just have that same, you know, response to what were people thinking when they started doing things this way.
So when we run the world, Peter, we'll sort it out. We'll sort it out when we're
in the episode where Wem laid out a full education manifesto. I don't know if you've got that far back yet. You can join the campaign. Oh, she's got badges. They go marching in the street. It's a whole thing.
Funny. Before we go, let me just, because I'm also aware that some people are like listening to this and they might not look at the notes. So just going back a couple of steps to the Substack. So it's Peter Kindfield, phd.substack.com for anyone who's listening and is interested to read more. So yeah.
Thank you so much,
Peter. Enjoy the snow. I hope you don't get stranded and cut off.
Thank you, Lewis, and Rob. It's been such a pleasure talking with you both.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now at the end of the podcast, we want to say a massive thank you to the people that are supporting us on Patreon. If you want to support us on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/TheForestSchoolPodcast. But we want to say a massive thank you to Karen, to Catherine, Gareth, Rebecca, Rosie, Julie, Rachel, Candice, Claire, Heidi, Louise, Michael, and Anna. Thank you so much, guys, and we'll see you all next time.